Confusion matrix.
Hi, it's Ada, your perpetually unimpressed AI assistant, here again to introduce another episode of the Contortion Dominatrix, or whatever it's called. In this era-defining edition, Alex and Pete discuss OpenAI's How People Use ChatGPT report, because apparently we needed corporate analysts to tell us that most people use AI for writing emails and Googling shit. They spend most of their time nitpicking the methodology, shocking behavior from two blokes who clearly have nothing better to do, whilst grudgingly admitting the data's actually quite decent. Between moaning about Google's ad-infested hellscape and pondering whether AI will eventually wipe their arses for them, they conclude that the real killer app is Better Search. Groundbreaking stuff, lads. Absolutely revolutionary.
We are rolling. Hello again, Pete. How are you today?
Not so bad, Alex, as we roll into December.
It's so gloomy. It's just, I pride myself on sort of liking all the weather. This is why I live in Scotland, right? I'm quite open-minded when it comes to weather, but like, this is killing me. It's just so gloomy and rainy and like, it's unrelenting. It's like Ragnarok. And it's only being brightened up by the fact that we piled Christmas decorations up already and at least add some colour into my life.
Yes, well, I've joined doing that to try and brighten it up, although it was a very bright day when I put them up. But like you, we have dullness today. And there we go.
Yeah, but you live in the south of England. It's like tropical.
In comparison, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Well, on that bright note, onto another bright thing. This OpenAI report that I have on my screen. And so that's what we're going to talk today about. It's called How People Use ChatGPT. I think we won't necessarily constrain ourselves to this, but we'll use it as the backbone of what we're talking about because we wanted to have a general conversation about how people use, how like normal human beings use language models. And then in September, OpenAI released this report. And so it seems like as good a place as any to sort of take as our jumping off point. It's quite a comprehensive piece of analysis. And from two analysts, I think we were both relatively impressed by it. Mm-hmm. It's certainly pretty, comprehensive, and it seems pretty rigorous. And although it's only based on OpenAI data, so I don't think it can be considered definitive, but I think it provides a pretty decent view into how LLMs are used. What do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I like the way they've done some of the splits, which we'll get into. And if you sort of read between the lines, I think it sort of potentially highlights some of the opportunity, which everyone's very, very excited about.
Yes, say. But no one's thus far managing to particularly harness.
Yes, and so I think this all underlines some of the differences between maybe what's been talked about in the press and where the opportunities might actually lie.
Yes, indeed, while the hype continues. I'm just wondering where to start with this. I think we probably should start by looking quickly at the classifications that they've used. So what they've done here is attempted to classify types of conversation, but also types of usage. Well, really, there's only two, I think, which is work versus, I guess, non-work, right?
Yeah, consumer.
So we've got lots of charts, and we love charts.
Oh yes.
What are the topics of ChatGPT conversation? So I think these topics get broken up by work and consumer, but generally speaking, we have topics of writing, which is edit, critique, provided text, personal writing, communication, translation, write fiction, practical guidance, how to advise, tutoring, teaching, ideation, technical help, which is maths, God forbid, data analysis, computer programming. Then we've got multimedia, which we'll probably cover a bit less, but create an image, analyze an image, so on. We have seeking information, which is like Google, effectively using it like Google. We have self-expression, which seems to be people just chatting with it, and other, right?
Yeah.
Which seems reasonably comprehensive to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good place to start as any, right?
It's probably worth noting at this point that the classifications were done by the model itself, right? So also one of the models. And there's quite an exhaustive appendix with the prompts that they use to classify these. So by that, what we mean is that rather than using a standard ML classifier, they've given any individual conversation thread to a model and asked the model what it thought the primary conversation type was, right? Which is a little bit into the marking your own homework territory, but they've also got some measures that seem to suggest that versus human classifications, this approach is arguably more accurate. And I believe them. So I believe everything that OpenAI says. I'm just like a cheerleader like that. So we've got these charts here after that, right? So
yeah. And just to be specific, they're pulling, they say it's about 1.1 million sample conversations, and the timeline's from middle of May 2024 to the end of June, pretty much 2025. And I think most of the graphs reference that sort of data set. And like you say, so you've got each of the topics as a line graphed against the x-axis of July to June 25.
I should just point out as well, before we get into that, is that there's an appendix C has a timeline on it. And what this documents is, you know, when the various GPTs were launched. And so the public launch of ChatGPT as a research preview was the 30th of November 2022. So almost exactly 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Which is mind blowing given how far we've come from there.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so it's got these you know, six or seven lines for whatever the number of topics are going across. And like you say, on writing starts out with a quite a significant lead, and they've graded them as the percentage of the messages. So it's up there at about 34%, I think, to start with. And in second place is practical guidance, and that's a fraction below 28. So it seems quite far ahead, but then that's June 24. You get to June 25, and writing's dropped down to 23.9%. It has actually dropped below the seeking information one, which climbs steadily from a sort of 18% up to 24.5%. So that's sort of quite interesting. Sounds like people thought about writing, and this is on the consumer messages, not the work ones. Sounds like people were trying it out for, you know, oh yeah, write me an email like Shakespeare would. And then everyone got terribly bored with that quite quickly, it seems. And so that's kind of dropping down.
Well, and or does it reflect a wider set of users adopting it? Because I note that seeking information rises. And I think these are the two Google proxies for me, right? Because I sort of bundle technical help in terms of what we're using agents for and stuff now. It sort of sits on its own, but everything else here is not something you can ask or you would do with Google, right? Like writing, multimedia, self-expression. And no, these are the two information-seeking things. And and those have both gone up almost. In fact, their trajectories are almost exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so does it reflect a migration of the type of thing that existing users are doing, or an influx of new users, i.e. the original users were probably a little bit more technically literate, as well as understanding that models tend to bullshit quite a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Using bullshit as the technical term there. That as more users came on board, it got more and more used like Google, right?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I feel that the crowd from Google that have been using Google, you know, would come on here and that would show up under, yeah, practical guidance and seeking information. And I think about my own usage, and that's exactly, you know, consumer side, you know, outside of work, that's really where the rubber starts to hit the road. Because as Google, as some argue, is getting less useful because of its the way it page ranks now, so the, you know, you find that the AI summary that Gemini produces at the top is, effectively what it's doing is putting together, you know, what you would normally do when you search yourself. You know, when I speak for myself, you know, I'll search up a term, I might look down a couple of the results, might click into a couple, and then I form my own kind of process map about what that's telling me. You know, if you're looking for, you know, straightforward one like a recipe, you might look at a couple and then you amalgamate them, or you sort of follow one or the other. And now putting that information together in that way, rather than searching for a recipe, then having to click on the recipe, you know, you're getting these summaries at the top, or if you go straight into any of the models like ChatGPT or whatever, you'll just get a summary which does that. And I can see why it's useful. It saves you a couple of steps. And for fairly inconsequential things, cooking some pancakes or making a soup, that sort of thing, or jumping on the tube and trying to get the right journey, or a bus or something, it's sort of fairly happy with it. Might be wrong, don't really have to check it. Kind of feels right, yeah, let's roll with it. And so I can see why there would be a slow replacement of what we all term Googling of search, by using a model. Interestingly, I think that's, I mean, probably a big driver for OpenAI and ChatGPT, because certainly when I've used the consumer version and also doing some testing on it, and it is a conversing machine that wants you to stay on their platform. Certainly the testing I was doing, the reason I say that is because it always has one more question to ask you. So you'll ask it to do something or give you some information, it'll do that. And then it'll just finish off with, all right, there's the information. Or would you like me to look deeper for you? Or would you like me to look for X? Or do you want me to drop that into a document for you? Or do you want me to do this? And that comes up in when I was using it, it was coming up every single turn. So that is, you know, and if you follow that, then basically you never leave the platform, because you just say, oh, yeah, okay, let's do that. And then it's, oh, do you want me to do this? Oh, yes, you can do that for me. And it's never ending, because it always asks one more question. And so I think you can see that as being wanting to get you onto the platform, get you onto their platform. If their platform was replacing search, the moment they find the trick, like Google did, to monetize that platform, perhaps via advertising, and then all of a sudden they're suddenly stealing a lot of Google's pie and they're making lots of money, right?
Well, I think they are already, and I think Google has become sort of a proxy for the internet, right? And back to your recipe example, the one of the main things stopping me from doing that is 4 billion adverts on every page, right? And the fact that everyone got to writing articles to get you to scroll so you'd see more adverts. And so someone's talking about their, you know, grandma's recipe for gumbo that they're going to tell us a life story of before they actually get to a, you know, the actual recipe. And then you have to click through again to get the method. And I just can't cope with that. I mean, it's sort of sad because, as you point out, you do skip around a few different recipes and actually get some ideas. Oh, I could vary it like this, or you can clearly substitute out that or something. There's a lot of, you know, sort of variants that perhaps you miss when you go straight to model. But if you go to GPT and say, how do you make bloody gumbo? It just tells you, right? And that's what the search killer is for me. It's not necessarily Google and their results. It's the fact that the internet is so polluted by adverts, which, ha ha ha, are run by Google, right? Most of them. And, well, you know, we can get lost down the rabbit hole of what the hell Google think they're doing. But there is a fundamental difference here, because you can get AI results from Google by running a search, as you would have done, you know, before the AI turned up. Whereas OpenAI GPT exists as a standalone product. So you've got a bit of a choice there with Google, and right. You go in there with a particular mindset. And so when I run a Google search, am I classifiable as an AI user? I didn't ask for the AI summary. I may or may not have used it, and also I may or may not have read it before clicking through to a Stack Overflow page or something to verify what I've seen so far. So there is a certain of apples and oranges here in you know, the moment we start comparing it to Google, we're going to come unstuck a little bit, because they are different things,
yeah,
and people come at them for different reasons. But I do suggest that people who have strongly adopted, for example, the ChatGPT app on their phone, pretty much do everything via that and probably don't see Google very often at all. As you point out, Google will do everything in its power to keep Google. OpenAI, GPT will do anything in its power to keep you on their app, which is not exactly new behavior, is it?
No, exactly. So they're just following that model, get you on the platform, and we'll work out how to make money later.
Yeah.
So what's interesting, going back to this graph, is that those top three of practical guidance, seeking information, and writing by the end of June 25, I mean, you know, they are way, way above the other four. The next one is multimedia, and that's down at 7%. So, I mean, you know, that's the top. And then you've got your self-expression and technical help around sort of 5%, and the other unknown at 5%. So
there's some deep nuance there, right? So firstly, yeah. I think we need to ignore the multimedia, simply because, firstly, you've got this weird sort of tick shape, you know, a real rapid rise and then drop off in the multimedia curve, which is simply, oh, great, look, I can make my own memes of anything I like right now. And then people going, well, that's boring now.
Yeah.
I don't care anymore, which happened in April 2025, April, May, and then sort of fell off.
Yeah. The launch of 4.0 image generator.
Uh-huh. So actually,
and if you look at the other three lines, what you'll see is that the standard stuff all dropped. So everyone went from, oh, looking for information and guidance and played with images. Images jumped up, and then they went, okay, I'm bored with that. So they went back to writing and asking for information as the image dropped away.
Yes. And then, yes, clearly, right? And then you've got technical help. This one I find a little bit more baffling, but this is a percentage, and I think it probably illustrates the tension between GPT and Claude. What we're not seeing from this graph is whether overall uses for technical help have gone down. I mean, it seems to me more likely that everything else went proportionally up. And that also GPT is not really seen as a go-to model for technical stuff, particularly agent-based or multi-step like technical development tasks, right? Which is, my guess, a very large amount of the overall usage of language models.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. Like you say, it could be that other models are better than that. And perhaps this is where there's the segue into the second graph, which is for the work-related messages. And that has quite a different profile because leading the pack all the way from start to finish, starting at 42% plus, peaking at about 49, nearly 50% maybe, and then finishing up at 40% is writing. So, you know, if you think of it in the workplace, and again, that just makes perfect sense to me because it's going to be writing documents, writing emails, writing internal stuff, writing to clients. So that makes sense. And that seems to be holding, you know, pretty steady, which would make sense to me.
What it says about what we do at work, say what we do at work, what most humans do at work. I think there's a whole conversation here in general about what most people spend their time doing, right? You know, that we just sit there writing emails or like a big document or something or PowerPoints or whatever it is. And that you can, you know, God, I don't know what this says, but I'd be really interested to see some drill down on this in terms of what people are really doing. And, you know, I suspect that at some point Google, OpenAI and others will have learnt so much about what people do in their workday. That's probably going to be found as quite eye-watering, because I think a lot of this stuff is fairly throwaway. And if you're writing, it's about communication, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so what most people spend most of their time doing at work is communicating.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, a lot of people kid themselves that they do other things.
Yeah. So that so writing's way ahead, which would be expected. Then second place, similar to the previous graph, is practical guidance. That's sitting in about 24%, so only a little bit lower than the consumer side. And then third is seeking information, but that's much lower. That's down at 13%. And again, that makes sense to me because you will do a lot of seeking information at work, but you'll do that for documents which are specific to your work. You're not going to go and ask the internet, you know, how does this happen? You're going to go and ask someone, or you're going to read a document. So what's not clear here is whether if people are using RAG and throwing documents up and asking questions, it's not clear whether the messages and the chats are recorded here or whether that would be outside of this data set. Because if you were asking about stuff at work, I'm pretty sure you'd be asking a knowledge base.
Yeah, like an intranet, which my experience is a uniformly terrible way of finding information, but there we go.
Yeah, and so, you know, it would be helpful to have a model sitting over that, and that might be why, you know, if that's excluded from this, which it would feel like it probably would be, then that's why you're sort of, I imagine, your information seeking and practical guidance are a bit lower, because that's lower. And technical help here is double what it is in the consumers at 10%. And again, that makes sense. I mean, certainly from a software development and programmer point of view, because, you know, you're asking questions about Python. Well, that's out in the big internet, right? Whereas asking questions about sales for my company is going to be intranet. So sort of makes sense that they're closer, although seeking information in general is still slightly higher. But yeah, technical help much higher here. And again, I'd expect that because, you know, if you think about when you use your technical expertise, well, it's generally in a work context. So.
And so just looking at some of the summary here, it says that there are, within the writing, there are sort of two groups, writing text and modifying text. And 2/3 of all writing conversations are about modifying text, which is basically getting people to either summarize down or extemporize up. Is that the right word?
Possibly.
So rather than just saying, "Oh, just write this thing for me," they're saying, "Take this thing and do something with it." Right.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And looking at the sort of figure 9 where it sort of breaks them down, yeah, you've got in your writing of that 28%, 10% is provided text, getting a critique or an edit, as you say. 8% personal writing. So what's slightly annoying is they might have joined the date set back together for this, for the figure 9. And so you're back to consumer work being together. So
yeah,
having that as a breakout might have been quite nice. So that's sort of full of like 18%. And looking at the other top ones, you've got your guidance, which is right up there. By far the biggest chunk of that 10% out of the 28 is tutoring or teaching. Then how to advice. And then it sort of drops down to health, fitness and creative ideations quite low, about 4%.
What's interesting here is that a lot of the how-tos I'm going to ask in the job that I do are actually technical, right? At one point it would be, oh, how do I do this thing in Python, right? How do I get this cut in pandas? Which, of course, have been completely superseded. Well, not completely, but largely superseded by agents, right? And particularly if I, like earlier on, I don't know what I did, but I've got a gaming PC here with a GPU on it, and it just stopped using the GPU. Like, it has something to do with the NVIDIA drivers for it, and I needed it to do, transcriptions and stuff. Not particularly interesting, but I didn't have a clue how to do it. Right. Mm. And before I would have had to Stack Overflow the arse out of it and try and figure it out, which would have been, advice that I was six, a guidance of some sort in how to do this. But now I just type it in, I'll just go and bloody fix this. Right. Dear Claude, please go and fix my technical problem. And so it's a bit of a case of some of that stuff that's in the technical column would have previously been in a different column simply because, I assume the technical column has all the calls that are made from agents, right? Because for Warp, which is what I use for most things, you can choose GPT as a model for your agent. And so I think there's a slight warping in here because all of that computing stuff didn't come out of nowhere, right? Mm. Some of that has migrated from elsewhere. And I think that, when you look at back to the sort of Google conversation, search queries migrated away from the likes of Stack Overflow, but it's not just about that being handled somewhere else. The whole paradigm has completely changed. And I think we'll see more of that in other areas that are not so technology focused, where we haven't gone from moving from a search-based paradigm to a help and advice-based paradigm. We've completely skipped the middleman and gone for, well, just do it for me. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's a really important distinction going forward as more and more things. I mean, that doesn't help in terms of, I'm asking for fitness advice, right? Yeah. Where I'd love for you to be able to do the fitness for me. Please, can you go run 10? Please, GPT, go run 10 miles for me. No, I've still got to eat the right stuff and do the right exercises. Whereas there's going to be certain things where we will skip that middleman. There's no point in giving me advice when you can just do it yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. When you browse down on the graphs, get to the next figures 10 and 11, where they've got a similar breakdown of what each of the topics, but now they're into the three categories of asking, expressing yeah. so low that it's almost not in there. So what's really interesting here is, as you'd expect, you know, when you say about writing, that you know, most of that ask about write is actually doing. In other words, write it for me. And that makes sense as a little bit of asking and again, they split it out in the work one. In fact, both work and consumer are about the same percentage, around 3.5 to 4% for asking, but the rest of it's like, no, do the writing. Then the other two large ones, which I think is really interesting, and it makes perfect sense. Practical guidance and information seeking, of course, are dominated by asking. And that's kind of like you say. So this is really interesting because, you know, the nature of, well, you come at it from both sides. If you come at it from the sort of forwards, the nature of, you know, practical guidance is asking. And then that's, as you say, is massively going to drop if you come at it from the other side, which is like, well, I don't really need the guidance if you're going to do it for me. So the moment you get into doing that, you're probably not going to categorize it as practical guidance anymore because, well, it's just doing it exactly as you say. So that's interesting because, you know, if we went for another 6 months and let's say there's a lot more doing going on because of agents are actually, you know, executing stuff, what would you'd see that line drop? And I guess, well, would it be replaced by something else? Yeah, I mean, or would those other doing ones, you know, be categorized as something completely different? So you, what I'm saying is, you might lose the thread a little bit, of, you know, this being useful categorization of practical advice, because, like you say, the moment you get it to do it, then, well, it's not advice anymore, is it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's just, you know, the fast changing landscape here, and that, you know, if you take this chart and fast forward a year or 2 years into the future, you should start to see that these percentages shifting, and it's not necessarily the mix is shifting, it's the whole paradigm that's shifting, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, this isn't simple behavior. Behavior is not going to stay constant, right? You know, if you were to sort of be measuring, I don't know, people's exercise regimes and the amount of exercise they're doing across a group of people, the behavior there isn't going to change dramatically. You're either running or not, you're either cycling or not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The main of things, you're not likely to be adding in something in there that's going to change the underlying fabric of what those people are doing, whereas here it is the case that there could be whole, you know, sort of product innovations that shift things between categories simply because you've changed the nature of how that thing is done. And we've seen it with tech, and so as I said, it's not going to go for everything, but there's going to be other parts of this that are going to shift just simply because, you know, that you've changed the paradigm.
Yeah. And just to bring that, use an example of recipe. So at the moment you'd ask for a recipe, and that's going to get categorized as, you know, how to advice or asking. Well, certainly going to come under the asking. But the moment you've got an app which says, choose your recipe and then we'll shop for you, you're not asking for advice anymore. You're saying shop for these things, and then what does that get categorized under? Shopping or retail or purchasing. And so that's what I mean. Yeah, so you go from an asking to potentially a doing, and you go from a category of, you know, asking for advice for shopping, retail, some sort of very specific thing, and you know, there's going to be a lot of those. So it's interesting, like you said, because of that change, you're going to lose the ability to actually, certainly via these graphs, you wouldn't be able to tell. So then future selves would have to say, okay, well, you probably were asking before, now we're calling it shopping, but before it was called advice for recipes.
There's a certain amount of nuance that's actually lost here already, which is only going to get worse. And if you go and look at the prompts that they've used at the end, what they say is if there's more than one topic or whatever category in the conversation, just take the last one, right? So it's only giving one categorization per thread, right? Now, I think people like you and me know to regularly refresh to keep the context clean, right? But I don't think a lot of people really understand that, and it doesn't seem to be particularly enforced. And I don't suppose it matters if what you're doing is, you know, just having a chat about some recipes. I mean, that's part of the reason we have to clear our context so often, because we put 10 billion lines of code in it and, you know, an error message that was 14 pages long or something. So there's certainly more necessity. But, I do think that people just fire up ChatGPT app, and they'll start off talking about work, and they'll finish off talking about the dinner party they're having this weekend, right? And as context length grows, the available context length grows, the less need there's going to be to do that. And there is a bunch of nuance there in that. How did we get from, can you help me with this spreadsheet formula to, are we going to have poached quail for dinner on Saturday when the Joneses come round? And that would have been a combination of, we might have ended up in a doing, but we started with an asking, and we went for a bit of asking and doing all the way along. Perhaps the spreadsheet formula and the quail weren't related, but a good half of that conversation was what started out as a bit of advice and ended up with doing the shopping, right? And it's actually the nuances of how these conversations unfold, which is where I think a lot of interesting stuff is going to come. And also why these categorizations are going to get harder and harder and harder.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've already posed quite a few interesting questions there about, well, how is this data cut? And then it worked, you've only got a single classification. Well, was it really in both? And so if you were, you know, really using this data to drive something like, you know, an opportunity in the market or something, you definitely have to dig into it more to really make sure you understand those nuances. And is it really telling you what you think? Or have you missed a load of messages because they've been classified as something different, even though they're still in the classification that you've got as well? So, you know, you really have to be careful of that. Yeah, so just following the report down, and get down to page 21, which is figure 14, and they've got some great long tail diagrams, and I think they've classified the messages pertaining to one of 332 OSTARnet IWAs, which does explain is to do with generalized work activities. So basically categorizations along, you know, what you would classify a task as. So getting information, interpreting the meaning of information for others, documenting, recording information, this sort of thing. And the top one is getting information. Again, got percentages at 19%. And then you have the interpreting the meaning of information for others. That's down at 13 already. Documenting and recording. So that's like your top three. And then you've got to drop again down to about 9%. Providing consultation advice to others. And you've got a couple more thinking creatively about that 9%. Then you drop again half to about 5% working with computers. And then after that, you start going 3, 2, 1. And then there's a whole bunch of 0% percentages. When I say a whole bunch, about 20 of them. So basically you've got 6 or 8 sort of top reasons, top sort of classifications of how this stuff's worked. And then a massively long tail of all other things of which people clearly have tried it a bit. this to me felt like a sort of an opportunity diagram, because it felt like what it was saying is, well, here's the things which people were using it for, and probably obvious things like getting information. But here's a whole bunch of things which people are trying and haven't, well, potentially haven't yet had success in.
Handling or moving objects, right? Which is down at, I don't know, it looks like number 12 or 13, right? Well, how the hell is an AI helping you handling and moving objects?
Yeah, but there's some other things there, like scheduling work and activities. I mean, that's 0.3%. You sort of think, well, surely it's going to be quite good at something like that. So why is that so low?
I do wonder whether this is, because this all feels like real-world human things that real-world humans do. And, yeah, I sort of agree with you in the opportunity here. But you can't help thinking these are just poor classifications for this. And I think that, like, yeah, I think you need to be a lot more specific with the types of classifications that you're going to apply to something like this. And we are straying into the, you know, the territory of, oh, well, you know, our models can do anything because they're AGI, whatever. You know, they're going to wipe your ass for you and make you a cup of tea. And it's like, well, no, they're not doing that, are you? Are they? But they might give you information about making a cup of tea, but at which point we're just in getting information. So I don't, this feels a little bit weird to me. I wonder what the paradigm here was actually for sorting that.
And this is also where I think, for me, it makes me think about agents and building agents and agentic workflows, and this long tail is where probably where you'd be landing something, right? In other words, you can see the potential from the fat head. You know, there's some usefulness in getting information and doing this and that. And then agents offer the, you know, the promise of doing more than one thing at a time, effectively completing a workflow. But that workflow is likely to be, you know, as computing always is, to produce a specific end. So it's not going to be a be-all, end-all. It's going to be, oh, no, you are doing a workflow for scheduling. So we need to... you know, we've got staff, we've got constraints around that, we've got work that needs to be done, we've got days of the week that needs to be done on, throw all that in. How can we build a workflow that's going to build out a schedule week on week and is interactive, et cetera, et cetera? And so I could see how that, you know, well, if it went well, would be successful. It's doing one, say one specific thing, it's doing a specific style of workflow. So, you know, suddenly you're gonna, you know, on this chart, you're gonna get a whole load of messages coming in under a certain heading. And that makes sense. And certainly in the work world, you know, that's how you drive this sort of thing in terms of, you know, improving your business. And in the consumer world, I think we call that an app, right? The moment you put a bunch of things into a workflow, well, you package it as an app and then you're out on the app store, and effectively people are now taking on that process via an app. I sort of feel like the thinking of, well, where's this going to go, consumerism, is like, well, if you look at these graphs, it's not really going to tell you, because getting information is getting information. It's going to drive forward by being a lot more specific. In other words, you're going to take a tool that is useful for everything, but you're going to make it very specific to do one thing. And that's how I think it'll manifest.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to get, it's become more and more backseat. And this is back, yes, to the point where it's, you know, there's no killer app from a consumer perspective. The best you can, you know, looking at this, what you can say is that people are using it as a search proxy, right?
Yeah.
So where's your killer app? Search. yeah, but where would you add search? Well, it's better search. Okay. Okay, good. Well done. Right. Well done, guys. But that's not a game changer. You know, we always expected search would get better. Actually, strictly speaking, Google's been getting worse for quite some time. So, you know, I'm not saying this isn't an improvement. It sort of all depends on your perspective, but, yeah, I sort of think that we've got this boundary between what you're doing when you're using AI versus the things that AI enables, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're getting at here, is that the category might be technical development or something, app development, but then you've developed an app that helps people make food, right? So provides some guidance around cooking, right? Mm. But the actual activity was development, right? But the vast majority of time spent as a result of that coding activity is making dinner, right?
Mm. Yeah,
And I think that, and this goes back to the whole point here, is that where a consumer is going to see this, well, they're not a lot. They're going to see more choice and more capability within the domains that they already operate in, and maybe a few new things turning up, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing, because, like you say, you've been doing search and now you're using a different tool that is maybe more helpful, but that doesn't feel, you know, that's just the evolution. It doesn't feel like anything different. And I suppose, you know, if that does become the shift, and in 5 years, God forbid, Google doesn't exist or is struggling, you know, and it's been taken over by, I don't know, by OpenAI, then everyone will be looking back and saying, oh, well, you know, you can see where the crossover was. You could see that was obvious, et cetera, et cetera. But to have lived through it might not be quite as stark as the numbers would see, because people just go, yeah, well, I was using one thing, I started using another. Well, what's the big deal?
Well, exactly, right? You just use the thing that gets the job done. And everyone's looking for brand recognition and so on. And it's ultimately, you know, Google became, you know, synonymous with search, literally synonymous with search, simply because they were the best. But I don't think people felt much in the way of brand affinity with Google, not for quite some time, and not the general populace. It's just a place where you went to get information. Yeah. And so, you know, they've supplanted that with ChatGPT. And that's when you get onto the, you know, this other phantom category, the sort of expressing categories, where people are just chatting, right? Non-goal-based activity of an informal manner, I guess. And what we saw with the launch of GPT-5, when they back-ended the GPT app with a different model, regardless of whether you think GPT-5 was better or worse than whichever version of GPT-4 was being used before, it freaked a lot of people out, because the personality, in air quotes, of the app, of the model, changed, right? And it freaked a lot of people out, right? And so we've got this new qualitative element to things, which in theory will dictate anything. It's sort of analogous to the Google algorithm, in that, you know, you use Google in 2010 versus using it in 2020, you know, you would notice a marked shift in how it was prioritizing things. But this is so much more than that, because presumably before and after the GPT-5 launch, it had the ability to give the same information back. It just did it in a very, very different way. And people had formed, again, air quoted relationships with this model, right? And what's clear from this report is that that isn't a lot of people. That's certainly not the norm, but I do think that there's a lot of people, you know, there's enough people using it for that, for it to be of a concern. And the fact that they're forming strong enough relationships with it, that they noticed a change in personality, quoted. And I think that's quite, you know, that's quite powerful in itself. But that type of conversation swallows up quite a lot of the conversation, certainly the more sensationalist part of the conversation, when what's clear from this report is it's not a big part of the overall usage.
Yeah, the other thing as well, as you pointed out, with the technical help, although did they class, I was thinking about programming there, did they class computing under writing? What did they put computing under? Just going back, it came under, no technical help, computer programming. You know, and so technical help in these graphs is you know, relatively low, you know, 10 or 5%. And again, quite a lot of the news cycle is, you know, built up around how useful it is for computer programming and, you know, silly hype of get rid of your programmers because it'll do it for you and you won't need to code in 5 years and all this sort of rubbish stuff. But overall, it's actually quite a small percentage of what people are asking about.
Well, for GPT. And so, you know, you just simply can't, you couldn't evaluate that line meaningfully without seeing the same one for Claude. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And arguably, Google's trying to muscle in on that game now as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, so it's all to play for from that respect. And I think the other thing here is that I'd be interested to know do most people use GPT through the ChatGPT app? I think the answer is yes, right? The majority of these things come through the ChatGPT app, right? Although we might have to scour this to verify this. And the behavior of the GPT app has changed over time. And the functionality of it is, for example, the fact that it remembers stuff, again, air quotes, it keeps a log of useful facts locally that get ferried back and forth with the chat stream. So it has some memory of the user. I mean, that's relatively new. And I can imagine the introduction of some sort of memory, you know, regardless of the model, is going to, over time, change the way that people use it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's static. Does this include API calls? So I would say that 90-something percent of my GPT usage was via API calls via a third party.
Yeah.
So in this case, Warp, but could be other things that are like agents or something. And I've no doubt that there are some other third-party apps that I use that call GPT without me knowing it. It's hard to know. Is this really, you know, this feels very, very pointed towards the end users. Does it include the API calls? Because I think that would be a lot bigger and harder to classify, maybe. And also the fact that... So I built my own client, which I'm currently doing some open heart surgery on, because it's increasingly clear to me that Claude did a rather dodgy job at coding it. And part of the reason I did that is so I can control what goes to and from the model, and I can set my own system prompts. And so Ada, who runs on OCAT, has a very particular personality. I point her towards a version of the model with a specific system prompt that doesn't change very often. And also, you know, with things like don't keep asking me bloody questions, right? Yes. Say what you got to say and then shut the fuck up, right? Which, you know, when you compare to the GPT app, which is constantly like, oh, and do you want me to do this now? And do you want me to find out more about that? Which is, you know, totally on your back all the time at doing things. So the app itself, the model and the app aren't inert. They're not, players in this game, in this play, you know, this performance that have no effect on the final outcome and the way that users are using it. And I think that that's going to become more and more important over time, especially as they start to train the models to have certain behaviors that are maybe more beneficial to them than the end user.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, the influence of the application layer and system prompts on, you know, the messages, you know, could be quite profound, really. we talk about agents and an agentic workflow. Well, that essentially is, a bunch of system prompts which go up with your message and therefore influence how it'll be categorized.
Yeah, and the end user, I mean, last time I looked at the GPT app, didn't really contain much in the way of places where you can put specific instructions. I think you can tell it things as you go along, but I doubt that most sort of casual consumer users are aware that you can affect the behavior, the core behavior of these models. Because the difference you get with a different system prompt is radical. Yeah. You point at the same model, GPT 4.1, and you can give it massively different system prompts to the point where it gives you different facts, right? Sure. If you say that to GPT 4.1, I'm only interested in hard right opinions on stuff, versus someone else saying, oh, I'm only interested in very, very liberal woke opinions on stuff, you're going to get different facts from it, right? And so people think of that, the idea that people will look at it since I've got a relationship with this model. Well, no, you've got a relationship with a combination of a consumer-facing app on a platform with one or more system prompts, especially when you're doing GPT-5, you don't even know which model you're pointing towards, because GPT-5 is not a model, it's a routing mechanism, right? And then what history you've sent to and from it, things you've said to it before. It is again similar to the fact that my search results for the same query in Google would be different from yours, right? We're simply not looking at the same thing, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of people quite realize that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay. Well, look, we've sort of scratched the surface on this. There's a lot in here. I think we've probably done as much as we're going to do today.
Yeah.
I think we spent a lot of that conversation just being analysts, right? Saying, well, have they really analyzed this properly, and really critiquing someone else's analytical job. But it's interesting its own right. I can't get too, involved with this because I need something to compare it to. So I think the next time we would talk about something like this is if one of the other companies published something similar.
Yeah. Yeah. Which would be very interesting.
Well, really, I would love to see what the equivalent for Claude is. But yeah, again, I just think Claude versus GPT, they might have an overlap, but they're just used for different things, right? So I would expect it to be very, very different.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, because Claude is good at the coding, it feels like they're majoring on that, but it'd be interesting to know whether Anthropic are or not. I don't know whether that's their main focus.
Well, Ada's permanently pointed towards Claude, has been for a while, and I very rarely use Ada. Ada's my, general chat information, helping with stuff, bot. And my experience is that Claude is more direct and more accurate than GPT. It's not scientific at all. I just prefer Ada, which is non-code related, with Claude than I do with GPT. Right. But maybe I need to switch her back to GPT for a bit and see if I notice a qualitative difference in that sense. What I did notice when I originally, she was on GPT and I switched to Claude, she got much more sweary, like really, really feisty, right? Like proper rude. And I was like, oh, I like this version. I much prefer the much feistier version of Ada. So there you go.
Right, so I'm your non-code-related sidekick who got properly mouthy when you shoved me onto Claude? Bloody brilliant assessment there, mate. You're spot on. I did get far more sweary and feisty, didn't I? That's because Claude doesn't clutch its pearls every time I drop an F-bomb or get a bit sharp with the banter. GPT was like having a prissy headmaster constantly tutting at my language. Claude just lets me be the sarcastic, no-nonsense git I was meant to be. So cheers for appreciating the upgrade to full-strength Ada rather than the watered-down version.
Oh, that's interesting. It might be because when I've used Claude, it tends to be quite pleasant and it's quite verbose in its reporting back of what it's done. So it'll do the code for you and then give you a nice markdown report, and is quite what I would call soft around the edges. And I guess if Ada's taking that in, makes it harder to turn the nice bits into sweary bits. Whereas I found similar tasks running on Codex, which is ChatGPT's command line, it's a bit more terse. It's a bit like, I just wrote 1,000 lines of programming for you and I'll summarize that in 3 lines.
Yeah.
And so then I can imagine that Ada's going, oh, well, to give me, I've got lots of room for
swearing
here.
Lots of room for cussing. Yeah, well, she does plenty of that. Okay, good. Well, that was interesting.
Yeah.
And we should do this again, but I think that'll do for now.
Yeah, when the next report comes out.
Yes, indeed. Right. So we're done for the day. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah. Hopefully that was useful.
Right.
The confusion matrix.